Welcome to the General Surgery Brief, your high-yield companion for AbSight and written board prep. In each episode, we break down challenging general surgery practice questions with detailed explanations, high-yield pearls, and key takeaways you can remember on exam day. So whether you're on call, on your way to the operating room, or commuting to work, this can be your go-to resource to stay sharp and ready. I'm Dr. Mustafa Farouk, first-year resident at the Medical College of Georgia. And together, we're going to make sure you're not just taking the exam, you're owning it. Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the General Surgery Brief. In this episode, we're going to be going over some anesthesia practice questions, and hopefully we'll cover some good content that's useful for your knowledge and for answering exam questions. So let's go ahead and dive in. Our first question, which of the following best describes the effects of volatile anesthetics, including sevoflurane, desflurane, and isoflurane? So answer choice A, these medications increase myocardial contractility. B, these medications depress hypoxic drive and myocardial function. C, they have a minimal effect on cerebral blood flow. And D, they protect renal blood flow. The answer choice is B. These medications depress hypoxic drive and myocardial function. So volatile anesthetics, these inhaled gases, sevoflurane, desflurane, and isoflurane, are short-acting medications, acting for 5 to 10 minutes. They provide unconsciousness, amnesia, and some analgesia. And they also depress respiratory drive and myocardial contractility. Now, contrary to the other answer choices, they do typically increase cerebral blood flow, so you have to be careful in patients that have increased intracranial pressure. They do decrease renal blood flow, worsening renal perfusion, and they do cause myocardial depression. Again, these medications have a short duration, so they have a rapid washout once they're discontinued. A pearl for these exams is that inhaled agents blunt the hypoxic drive and depress cardiac output. Next question. Which volatile agent is most commonly used for mask induction because it is fast-acting and causes minimal airway irritation? A. Sevoflurane, B. Desflurane, C. Isoflurane, or D. Nitrous oxide? The correct answer is A. Sevoflurane. Sevoflurane has a smooth onset, it's non-pungent, and causes minimal laryngospasm. Therefore, it's best for mask induction, especially in kids. The other choices, desflurane has the fastest on and off, but it's very pungent. It can cause coughing and laryngospasm. Therefore, it's used for maintenance, not induction. Isoflurane is an older agent, and it has a slower onset. Finally, nitrous oxide is rapid, but it's not potent enough to induce anesthesia alone. It's usually used as a carrier gas. So the pearl here is that sevoflurane is used for induction, and desflurane is used for a rapid wake-up. Therefore, you're more useful during cases rather than for induction, unlike sevoflurane. Next question. A 55-year-old man with an SBO, small bowel obstruction, should not receive nitrous oxide because A, it causes severe hypotension, B, it diffuses into closed spaces and can expand them, C, it depresses cerebral blood flow, or D, it causes malignant hyperthermia. The correct answer is answer choice B, it diffuses into closed spaces. So nitrous oxide moves rapidly into air-filled cavities. Therefore, it can worsen small bowel obstructions, pneumothorax, or middle ear disease. It causes minimal myocardial depression. Therefore, it's actually relatively safe in congestive heart failure. And it increases cerebral blood flow, not decreases, unlike choice C. Finally, it is not a trigger for malignant hyperthermia. That's succinylcholine and other volatile anesthetics. So the pearl here is to never use nitric oxide in small bowel obstructions or pneumothorax. Next question. The most common cause of intraoperative bradycardia is A. Propofol, B. inhalational anesthetics, C. hypovolemia, or D. ketamine. The correct answer choice is B. inhalational anesthetics. So volatile anesthetics depress the sinoatrial node and the vagal reflex, therefore causing bradycardia. The treatment for this is atropine. Looking at the other answer choices, propofol causes hypotension, not bradycardia, though sometimes bradycardia can occur. Hypovolemia will actually cause tachycardia, not bradycardia, and ketamine increases heart rate and blood pressure via catecholamine release, so it doesn't cause bradycardia. Next question. A patient develops fever, eosinophilia, jaundice, and elevated LFTs after repeated anesthetic exposure. What is the diagnosis? A. Sepsis. B. Volatile anesthetic hepatitis. C. Propofol infusion syndrome. Or D. Transfusion reaction. The correct answer choice is B. Volatile anesthetic hepatitis. So volatile anesthetic hepatitis is caused classically by halothane, but it can occur with others. The mechanism here is immune-mediated hepatotoxicity, and the risk increases with repeated exposures. Looking at the other answer choices, propofol infusion syndrome is a syndrome of metabolic acidosis and cardiac failure with prolonged high-dose propofol infusion. Sepsis and transfusion reactions can cause fever and jaundice, but would less likely cause eosinophilia. So from here, for the remainder of the episode, I'm going to try to give a more of an assortment of questions rather than just focusing on one topic. All of these questions will be related to anesthesia, but rather than going through one topic at a time, I'll try to touch on a variety of topics and hit the learning points for each topic. So let's continue. All right, so which IV anesthetic is the most commonly used for induction? Now, this IV anesthetic has a rapid on and off, but it doesn't provide any actual analgesia, and as side effects, it causes hypotension and respiratory depression. So our answer choices include propofol, etomidate, ketamine, and dexmedetomidine. The correct answer here is propofol. So propofol is the gold standard for IV induction, and it has a rapid onset and offset. A side effect of propofol is hypotension, that's the most common side effect, but you can also get respiratory depression and burning on infusion. Taking a look at the other answer choices, etomidate is good for patients who are hemodynamically stable, so patients with poor cardiac function, this is a good drug for them. A side effect of etomidate that's useful to know is adrenal suppression. Now, ketamine provides analgesia as well as anesthesia. And it preserves respiration, but it can cause hallucinations and tachycardia and hypertension. Now, dexmedetomidine is an alpha-2 agonist. It provides sedation and analgesia, and it doesn't cause any respiratory depression. And we've all probably heard of dexmedetomidine as Presidex. So the pearl here to learn is that propofol does not cause any analgesia. Is useful for anesthesia. Etomidate is good for patients with poor cardiac function because it doesn't have any hemodynamic side effects. And then ketamine, again, hallucinations, tachycardia, hypertension. All right, so our next question. Which of the following is the correct order of steps in RSI, or rapid sequence intubation? The steps we can choose from are giving the paralytic, induction agent, pre-oxygenation, and cricoid pressure. So what's the correct order of these four steps? Again, you have paralytic, induction agent, pre-oxygenation, and cricoid pressure. So the correct pathway is to pre-oxygenate the patient, then give the induction agent, then the paralytic, and then provide cricoid pressure. So let's go through these steps by steps. Step one is pre-oxygenation. Of course, you give 100% oxygen via a tight-fitting mask for a few minutes. And of course, this creates an oxygen reservoir so the patient can tolerate apnea during intubation. Next, you're going to give the induction agent. Now, this is a sedative or a hypnotic to make the patient unconscious. Choices include etomidate, or propofol or ketamine. And again, this ensures the patient isn't awake during the intubation procedure. Next, you give the paralytic. This, you're giving neuromuscular blockade to relax the muscles, allowing smooth passage of your ET tube. Now, succinylcholine is the fastest, but rocuronium is an alternative if contraindications exist to sucks. Finally, the last step is cricoid pressure, or the Selleck maneuver. Now, this is when an assistant presses on the cricoid cartilage to compress the esophagus, aiming to reduce aspiration risk. Now, it's important to note that evidence for the Selleck maneuver or cricoid pressure is mixed, but it still remains a classically taught RSI step. So again, the logic here is to oxygenate first, then make the patient unconscious, then relax their muscles, and finally add the aspiration prevention maneuver. Some key pearls to take away: RSI is rapid because all the drugs are given in quick succession, and bag mass ventilation is generally avoided to reduce aspiration risk. Now, some different aspiration risk factors are recent food intake, pregnancy, small bowel obstruction, gastroparesis, or GERD. Now, we mentioned the Selleck maneuver, which is there to prevent aspiration, but you may also hear of the BURP maneuver, the B-U-R-P, which stands for backward, upward, rightward pressure. And this is there to improve laryngeal view. All right, next question. Arrange these local anesthetics in order of duration of action. We have bupivacaine, lidocaine, and procaine. So the correct answer is actually the way I recited the names. It's bupivacaine, then lidocaine, and then procaine in order of duration of action. So bupivacaine is the longest acting of these three, and it's excellent for prolonged blocks, but it's also the most cardiotoxic. Lidocaine is intermediate acting, and it's versatile and safe when you dose it correctly. Finally, procaine is a short-acting that's rarely ever used now. A memory trick you can remember is bupivacaine for big duration. All right, our next question. In which of the following situations should epinephrine not be used with local anesthetics? A, in patients with unstable angina. B, in penile blocks. C, in ear laceration repair. Or D, all of the above. The correct answer choice here is all of the above. Now, epinephrine, when you combine it with local anesthetics, increases safety generally. You can give a higher dose of local anesthetic because the drug is staying local due to that epinephrine. However, you really want to avoid using epinephrine in end arterial areas. This can include fingers, toes, penis, ear, the tip of the nose, or the placenta, because you can cause risk of ischemia. You also want to avoid epinephrine with your local in patients that have arrhythmias, unstable angina, or uncontrolled hypertension. In general, combining epi with your locals is safe in most soft tissue closures. All right, next question. So a patient with renal failure receives meperidine or Demerol for pain and develops seizures. What is the mechanism of this patient's seizures? We have A, histamine release, B, norepinephrine metabolite accumulation, C, rapid redistribution, or D, interaction with benzos. The correct answer choice is B, norepinephrine metabolite accumulation. So meperidine or Demerol is metabolized to norepinephrine, a neurotoxic metabolite. In patients with renal failure, this metabolite accumulates and can cause tremors, fasciculations, and seizures. Taking a look at the other answer choices, histamine release is more commonly associated with morphine. And opioids interacting with benzos typically leads to synergistic respiratory depression, but not necessarily seizures. So again, the takeaway here is to never use Demerol or meperidine in patients with renal failure. All right, next question. Which opioid is the most potent clinically used narcotic? Morphine, fentanyl, sufentanyl, or remifentanyl? So the correct answer choice here is sufentanyl. So sufentanyl actually has 10 times the potency of fentanyl, and it's the most potent commonly used opioid. Now morphine, of course, is the baseline opioid, and fentanyl is around 80 times stronger than morphine. Remifentanyl has an ultra-short half-life, but it's not the most potent. Again, sufentanyl is the most potent clinically used narcotic. All right, next question. What is the reversal agent for benzodiazepine overdose? Naloxone, atropine, flumazenil, or epinephrine? The correct answer choice is flumazenil. So flumazenil is a competitive GABA antagonist and reverses benzodiazepines. Now, the risks associated with flumazenil are that it can precipitate seizures, especially in patients on chronic benzodiazepines or those with increased intracranial pressure. The other answer choice is naloxone is used for opioid reversal, atropine treats bradycardia, and epinephrine we know is used for anaphylaxis or asystole. All right, next question. So a patient develops acute back pain at an epidural site, followed by loss of motor and sensory function and urinary retention. What is the most likely diagnosis? We have an epidural abscess, epidural hematoma, a malpositioned catheter, or local anesthetic overdose. The correct answer here is epidural hematoma. So when you have sudden severe back pain and then neurologic deficits like motor, sensory, bladder, or bowel after placement of an epidural, the ab site or exams want you to recognize this as a surgical emergency. You need an emergent MRI as well as urgent decompressive laminectomy. The other answer choices, like epidural abscesses, present with fever, back pain, and neurologic deficit, but these typically develop over days, not hours. Now, a malpositioned catheter would typically cause a unilateral block, not bilateral deficits as well as pain. Finally, an overdose of local anesthetic would cause cardiac and CNS toxicity, but not really focal neurologic deficits. All right, next question. A patient with poor exercise tolerance, so less than 4 mets, only slow walking and light activities, needs an elective colectomy. What is the next step in preoperative evaluation? You can proceed with surgery without testing. You can do a non-invasive stress test using dobutamine and thallium. You can do coronary catheterization, or you can start perioperative steroids. So the correct answer here is to do non-invasive stress testing. So for surgery, functional capacity is key. Greater than or equal to 4 mets, you're safe to proceed. But less than 4 mets, you want to do a pharmacologic stress test using either dobutamine and thallium or adenosine and dipyridamole. A positive stress test indicates ischemia, and therefore you want to do a coronary angiogram before surgery. Now it's important to note that in general, preoperative revascularization in non-cardiac surgery rarely improves outcomes unless standard indications exist. All right, next question, and we're getting to more of the surgical stuff, so a little bit more exciting. So an intubated patient undergoing laparoscopy develops a sudden rise in end-tidal CO2, followed by a precipitous drop and hypotension. What is the most likely diagnosis? You have hypoventilation. You have disconnection from the ventilator. You have CO2 embolism, or you have malignant hyperthermia. So the correct answer here is CO2 embolism. And let's talk a little bit about this to help us understand why. So what exactly is CO2 embolism? Now, of course, during laparoscopy, the abdomen is insufflated with CO2 to create pneumoperitoneum. If a trocar or needle enters a vessel, especially larger venous channels, CO2 can be forced directly into the circulation. This creates a gas embolism that obstructs blood flow and stresses the right heart, similar to an air embolism. So what's going on in the monitor with that end-tidal CO2? First, you're going to have a transient rise in the end-tidal CO2. So as the CO2 first enters the bloodstream, it dissolves easily because CO2 is very soluble and is exhaled. So you see a brief spike in that exhaled CO2. Then you have a sudden precipitous drop in your end-tidal CO2. So once that large embolus obstructs the pulmonary outflow, less blood reaches the alveoli, so almost no CO2 can be delivered to the lungs. Finally, you get hypotension and cardiovascular collapse. That CO2 embolus acts like a massive pulmonary embolism, basically, causing RV strain, decreases left side filling, and shock. Now, talking about the other answers, hypoventilation, you'd have a gradual increase in end-tidal CO2 because you have that slow accumulation of CO2, not a sudden crash. What about disconnection from the ventilator? End-tidal CO2 would just show a sudden drop to zero. There wouldn't be an initial rise. Finally, malignant hyperthermia, you have this progressive rise in end-tidal CO2. Remember, you also get things like muscle rigidity, tachycardia, hyperthermia. You don't just get this sudden, shocky crash. So again, in CO2 embolism, you get that unique biphasic pattern. First, you get a rise and then a sudden fall with hypotension. Again, this is a key combination of varus needle or trocar misplacement into a vessel. So the management, just for some extra stuff, you'd want to stop insufflation immediately. You want to place the patient in left lateral decubitus and Trendelenburg, which is called the Durant maneuver, and this traps gas in the right ventricular apex, prevents the embolus from entering the pulmonary outflow tract. Now, if a central line is in place, you can aspirate some gas, and in general, you want to give supportive measures like 100% O2 fluids. If the patient's extremely shocky, you want to start pressors and then ACLS if needed. So just remember, CO2 is more soluble than air. So small emboli are often tolerated. It's the large CO2 bolus that can cause the crash. I think that'll wrap it up for this first episode of the General Surgery Brief. Thanks for joining us for this episode covering anesthesia-related questions. And again, this is not the only anesthesia episode we're going to have. The goal of the podcast is to touch on a lot of different subjects in general surgery over time, and then just keep on circulating between these different subjects. So if you're following along with our podcast, you'll be able to get a bunch of different review style questions. If you have any concerns, comments, questions, or advice, please feel free to email us at the email in the episode show notes. We hope you'll join us for our next episode, and we hope you found this episode useful. Again, if you have any tips for us or recommendations you think would be more helpful, please feel free to let us know. Thank you. Have a blessed one.